the complaints in the circuit and district court, and that we'll have a much simpler system, albeit manual in those ones who are not computerized. Now, if we have one numbering system straight through, then you don't need to have the fingerprints go along with the final disposition report, because you can connect them together using a single numbering system. So I think those mechanics can be worked out. The problem now is people don't have any real reason to do what's supposed to be done, and it's not being done.
Let me just put the question back to Ms. McCoy, is it?
Yes.
If the law passes, if we pass the bill and pass out as law, basically it directs that this activity be done, and I assume that that's the priority by which it would be given, given the interest here. What would you, given if there were no more, if it was laid upon your desk to do this, what would not be done in its place? Would you somehow manage to do this if given the right amount of forms, that sort of thing? If the system was set up right, would it cause an impact on your workload?
What would happen is there would probably be delay in getting that done, prioritized or not, because unfortunately most of what comes into a court system is already prioritized. I cannot delay the receipt of cases as they're being filed. We cannot delay the administrative level, the docketing, the calendaring, the entry into the system of all of the information. We cannot slow down the operation of the courts. We cannot slow down the judgment and docket entry, depending on which department we're in. And usually what happens is if we have to delay anything, it's at the tail end of something. It's the last process, because the disposition process you can delay. And that's unfortunate, but that is usually what happens if you're overloaded or if you can't handle all of the workload.
Okay. Mr. Linden, you had a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest that I don't think there's disagreement among the people here at the table that this is information that is very much needed and perhaps hasn't had the priority that it should have received in the past from the district attorneys or from the courts on misdemeanors. If you want to shift the function, I guarantee you, based on the feedback we've got from trial courts, there will be an expense. The Ways and Means process is one place with which to deal with that expense, if you're not going to adopt amendments about the electronic data processing. And I think that I can say for myself that, you know, we need this information and it's got to be collected somehow. There might be a cost to collecting it, but if that cost is not outweighed by the value of the information, then the legislature can decide that it's worth putting the money into it that's going to require to get it done.
We have a fiscal analysis here which is dated March 12th that shows about a $342,000 fiscal impact in the 87-89 biennium. Is that current?
Mr. Chair, when we surveyed the courts, it's still current. It's based on the estimates of the courts as to what portions of full-time equivalent employees would be needed to perform this function. That would be 7 positions over 36 counties.
Okay, what's the pleasure of the committee on this one? Do you want to... there's actually no specific amendments offered. Did you offer amendments?
Mr. Chair, I offered amendments that would have phased in as we automate our courts. They're attached to the letter of April 2nd addressed to you.
Sorry. Okay, there are some amendments which are attached. The effect of these amendments would be to phase in the... let me ask if there is an interest in that amendment. I'm just to give you a feeling here, I'm a little bit torn on this one because it would seem to me that I can understand from a management viewpoint overall it would be reasonable to phase these things in. I'm getting a sense from the discussion here, however, that the committee would prefer, at least Representative Baumann would seem to prefer, that we go through with the bill as it stands. Representative Phillips Springer, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I can appreciate the concern of the administrator's office, and I guess I'm willing to go so far as to suggest a specific effective date of, say, January 1st, 1988, in order to give them a period of time in which to adjust and prepare for this, since I think that's going to be inevitable in terms of preparing for the responsibilities and hopefully being able to integrate the information that's required of the various law enforcement agencies. So I don't know if that's, I doubt it's acceptable to all the parties necessarily, but it might be a way that we'd at least allow some lead time and presume, I think that's about the only amendment that I could support at this time.
Can I take that as a form of amendment that you wish to include that the effective date of this would be January 1st, 1988? Making an amendment, over here.
Well, I, you know, and I would be open to comment from any of the people at the table in terms of whether or not January 1st, or, you know, I'd be amenable to extending it less or further, I guess. I don't want to impose too heavily on anyone.
I really hate to be as hard-nosed as I'm being about this, but we're putting out, year after year, we're putting out, in effect, fake reports because the data's phony. And we're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars producing, in effect, phony data that we can't use and we can't rely on. It seems to me that your choice ought to be to say we're simply not going to get the data for 4 years, or you ought to get it now. And whatever it costs, get it, because the costs of not having it are going to be so much greater. And it seems to me it ought to have a high enough priority so that it produces that kind of result. I think, as a practical matter, setting the entry date over 1 year means we're not going to have any reliable data until the end of the year 1988, the beginning of 1989. By that time, the decisions on construction program will be made. We will be struggling to develop our guidelines will presumably be worked out by that time, and we won't have the data to do it. So I think it's a hard choice, but I think it's one that has to be faced now.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, the late effective date would be beneficial in terms of planning. I don't think it necessarily addresses the central issue, which is if we're going to take on a new function, we're going to need some help from the legislature in terms of financing. And I would, I don't think I disagree with Judge Beatty that the longer we delay the implementation, whether it's the DA's doing it or us, whether it's done electronically or manually, assuming that the resources come with it, the longer it's going to be before the decision makers have the information that they need to make decisions about sentencing policy and things of that nature.
This does have a subsequent in Ways and Means, so. Mr. Mayor, do you want to?
It was an idea which I think I'll reserve a motion this
no
time.
Motion.
If it does have a referral to Ways and Means, I guess ultimately the issue is going to be resolved down there in terms of its fiscal impact.
May I?
Representative Bowman?
It seemed to me that we've had testimony from two judges with considerable experience in circuit court, that this is something, maybe I'm misinterpreting, particularly Justice Jones, your testimony, but this is something that could be accomplished with no fiscal impact. My reaction to the complaint of the state court administrator of the great additional cost is that is really, unfortunately, a way to frustrate this occurring, because the fiscal, I mean, everybody's in tight with money. I appreciate that it should be examined, but I also just want my response to be clear that seems to me to be somewhat obstructive of the intent of this, which I think is progressive, and I think it should be implemented immediately, and I think that it's something that relies upon creativity in coming up with a new form and an allocation that takes into account the priority that the system should give to keeping track of its own actions some kind of sensible manner. So I'm just frustrated by the state court administrator's position on this.
Mr. Linden.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to respond to Representative Bauman's comments. If I oppose this bill on the merits, I would have told you so. What I'm doing is reporting the fiscal impact information that we receive from our trial courts. That's all, period.
I appreciate that. Yep. There seems to be some conflicting information available to the committee.
Yeah, one of the things also, of course, we're facing here a long, long period of benign neglect, I guess, in the system that everybody here in this room, certainly those of us at this table and that table there, are working to try to resolve, and there is an impetus to that that has been placed on the things that have been happening the last couple of years that places a high degree of urgency on the issue. I'm Representative Bauman, I share your interest in trying to come to moving the system in that direction, but I think that Mr. Linder is in his proper role in advising us as to what the potential impacts of that might be, and I think that's what he has done here. My guess is with this amount of money that's all potentially on it, that argument will have to be made as far as the cost impact down in ways and means, and I'm going to do that. Representative Springer?
I'd move the bill to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves House Bill 2551 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Clerk, call the roll.
Bauman?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye. Thank you, gentlemen.
I guess a vote explanation. I made the motion and I voted for it because I believe it's sound policy. If there's a fiscal problem, we'll work as closely with Ways and Means Committee as we can to get the answer there and hopefully can proceed on its way through the process.
Okay, let's go to, need to have a work session 2556, if I can find it. We did not have a hearing on that. I mean, we did have a hearing on that. We haven't had a work session. There's a cross-reference to House Bill 2093, which is dealing with the same subject. Has that been Bill Benhood?
Yeah, I think we're not thank because of this bill.
Oh.
And my recollection.
Okay. This bill deals with continuous release authority. It's an OJOP bill. Did you want to come up on it? Mr. Watson?
Yeah, I think it was a judicial bill, wasn't it?
There are some amendments that you proposed, which are dated April the 2nd. There is a fiscal impact statement, which has been provided, and I think that's it. Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Watson of the Jail Overcrowding Project staff. We did submit an amendment with three parts to it today. One responds to the concerns of Sheriff Peirce of Multnomah County that he has several facilities and he didn't want, as the bill was originally drafted, to require a release authority to every one of those because he only releases from one facility. So that's the first amendment. The second amendment has to do with civil liability of the staff that make these decisions. It's a concern of the Sheriff's Association and those who now do that in 18 counties. They're just wondering under what authority, and with this bill in, they've requested us to make that change or addition to this bill, which is the second section. And of course, the third amendment we propose is what we've done with all of these, and that's remove the request to remove the sunset provisions for the council. We've done on each one based upon information from the council that those sunset provision should remain in effect through this next interim.
Okay. thank you. We are under a call, and I'm wondering, Representative Springer, are you looking up something here on the bill?
Well, I just wanted to check the reference to the Tort Claim Act 2653C, the immunity provision. I don't know if that's exactly where that amendment ought to go, but...
Okay. Well, we're under call, so we're going to have to adjourn, and once the call is over, we'll adjourn. So I want to move right to that bill. This relates to forfeiture of conveyances in certain cases. And Chief Sponsor of the bill, Representative Minnis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Minnis. I'm representative from District 20 in Multnomah County. I'm offering testimony this afternoon. Originally, if you're looking at my notes, it said good morning, and staff recognized it may be evening here real soon, but I did want to greet you by saying good afternoon. I'm here to testify on House Bill 3180, which permits the seizure and forfeiture of vehicles used in prostitution enterprise. The reason for introduction of this measure is to create a statute that utilizes an innovative method of dealing with prostitution in the state of Oregon. I've asked legislative research to find out if other states have used this seizure of vehicles, have used seizure of vehicles in prostitution cases. Their study, 87233, which is not comprehensive, indicated that no state currently has such a law. Legislative research provided Senator Jan Wyers copies of statutes in Maryland and Virginia, which was their number 86101 on January 29th of this year. The law in Maryland addresses transportation for immoral purposes and provides a penalty of a $500 fine, 1 year in prison, or both. It also requires the forfeiture of the person's driver's license and right to drive as long as the court may direct. The state of Virginia has a statute which prohibits transporting or attempting to transport any person for the purpose of unlawful sexual intercourse or prostitution, and the penalty is not defined in the copy of the Virginia law that I have. The potential seizure of a vehicle used in prostitution, I believe, is a good idea. As you know, prostitution is a continuing problem in the metropolitan Portland area. Enforcement of the crime is difficult and requires specific guidelines be applied. Prostitution activities involve, very obviously, prostitutes, pimps, johns or customers, and in many cases, a vehicle. Vehicles are used to transport prostitutes. Pimps use vehicles to watch their girls on the street, and I probably should say also boys, since that seems to be on the increase also. The johns use their cars to pick up prostitutes, and either the act is committed in the car or the car is used to transport the prostitute to a location where the act is committed. House Bill 3180 is a good step in the right direction to discourage customers or prostitutes from seeking out sexual services. More importantly, it should be applied to prostitution enterprises, i.e. pimps and out-call massage parlors. If the focus is directed by police and prosecutors on the enterprise of prostitution, I believe law enforcement can significantly reduce the level of financial incentive to be involved in that crime. It is my personal opinion that prostitutes are the victims of one of the greatest human rights violations that exist today. As a law enforcement officer, I have never met a prostitute who was engaged in that activity on a voluntary basis. They are there because they have been reduced to the activity by pimps who prey on their lack of a healthy self-image and poor self-esteem. Many are runaways who have been beaten and abused by pimps who involve them in drug use and other criminal activity. The abuse of young men and women who have found their way to the street are compounded by the seemingly normal and upstanding citizens who seek out their services. I've had the opportunity to speak with many prostitutes about their activities. Their own explanation of the services that they provide would shock most of us here today. At least I would hope. I've said all of this to say that prostitution is not the victimless crime that has been purported to be by criminologists and sociologists in our academic communities. It is a human tragedy involving people who are the victims of others who prey on them because of their inability to recognize their worth and value to society. House Bill 3180 utilizes the statutes for seizure and forfeiture of vehicles and requires the involvement and discretion of the court. A car may only be forfeited upon conviction of a crime related to prostitution, and these statutes are used in forfeitures regularly, and the procedures are well set into practice. I want to thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions. If you'd like, I can also go over the bill and explain the different sections to you. I've hopefully given you copies of the ORS that is relevant to the seizure, and ORS 471.660 and sub 8 describes the fact that their conviction is necessary for the forfeiture of the car. Glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Minnis. Effectively, what, if, as far as the bill itself goes, it would be taking the conveyance of seizure of conveyance statutes on liquor and applying them to the case of a prosecution of a person convicted of prostitution. Is that?
Well, it would be prostitution or a prostitution enterprise. In other words, solicitation would also be there, and promoting prostitution would also be included. Along with the crime itself of prostitution.
Isn't it an ordinance in Portland, I believe, that you have to arrest a seller, you have to arrest a buyer?
I don't believe that we have that kind of a policy, and perhaps the people in the city of Portland can say testify to that. There are some states that do have that kind of a policy, that in fact both parties would have to be arrested.
I guess I understood that was an ordinance, but I'm getting a negative signal from behind you as well. How many cases do you think this would apply to? How often do you think this would? Do you have any sense of how many convictions in the city of Portland there is annually for that would that this would apply?
I don't have any numbers that I could give to you, and again, I would have to defer to the city of Portland. I would say that the number that it would apply to, or could potentially apply to, would be significant. There are a significant number of prostitution cases and prostitution enterprise cases in Multnomah County every year.
I guess the question I'm asking is usually, and my knowledge of prostitution is that the prostitute solicits from the street. There's no vehicle involved on the part of the prostitute, but that the pimp may have it, and the person who purchases the services, if you would, will have a vehicle. And where are the convictions? Are the convictions against the prostitutes, against the pimps, or against the giants?
Could be all.
There are lots of them.
Could be all. In fact,
you know, under the law, I know it could be all, but my question is, how many convictions do we find? Again, do you have any idea what the percentage of convictions are against prostitutes themselves, against their pimps, and against the people who are soliciting?
Again, no, I don't. My own personal knowledge would be there are probably more prostitutes who are arrested and convicted rather than the Johns themselves.
Okay. Any other further questions? Thank you.
Question.
Taylor?
Minister, what I understand of the RICO statute, what was used particularly in drug cases, it was successful at first against a lot of drug dealers, but the more professional ones switched from buying cars to renting cars and boats. Just wondering whether we would have the same thing happen in this area if this were to become law.
Well, I think that's probably a good observation, because in fact that could occur in the criminal enterprise. It has been suggested, although the amendments to this bill are not present, that in fact what we should do is expand this bill to include not only the cars but property that is owned by a criminal enterprise, and that, when that was first inquired about, dealt with the outcall massage parlors. In a recent case in Portland, where they developed a significant case against outcall massage parlors, they have no ability to seize property because it's not being done under the RICO statutes with the Attorney General. But I think your point is well taken, and it could very well happen that they would go rent the cars, and under that, if that did occur, then in subsection 4, of course, this statute would not apply to the seizure of that vehicle.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Minnis.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Koch, are you here to testify on this?
Thank you very much. Bob Koch, Commissioner, City of Portland. I'd like just a few comments, and then I think I can address some of your questions. First thing is, and this was handed to me just before leaving City Hall this afternoon, and somebody who wanted to testify, but I would like to read it for the record. It's from Helen Stoll, dated April 2nd, Legislative Committee, Dick Springer, Representative State of Oregon, to whom it may concern, reference prostitution automobiles. As Secretary of Neighborhood Rescue, as Treasurer of the Hollywood Neighborhood Association, and as President of the Oregon Apartment Association, I would like to support House Bill 3180. Here in the Hollywood District, we experienced a bad sequence of events involving pimps, madams, prostitutes, and recruiters on Sandy Boulevard, involving Grant High School students. Hollywood and Laurelhurst Neighborhood Associations, business people on Sandy Boulevard, and churches pressured the mayor and police until we finally got results after 6 years of agony. We are very supportive of the King neighborhood, 82nd Avenue residents, and business people of all those working on House Bill 3180. The support of the legislature in this matter will be greatly appreciated, and I'll certainly give this to you. I'd like to kind of go back historically, and I've been a police officer for 19 years. I didn't prepare any testimony. I thought I'd just kind of open up my experience and share it with you on this matter. And during that time, I personally observed where the city's jurisdictions locally have spent millions of dollars enforcing street prostitution laws to no avail. At best, what we run is a Band-Aid operation. It's kind of a holding action. It's less than an open city, but unfortunately not sufficient in spite of the massive resources we throw at the problem. It's not sufficient to essentially get it down to where it isn't prevalent. Now, what typically happens with police pressure is we'll go down to Union Avenue, and I know there's several of you here who understand Union Avenue in Portland, but we'll go down to Union Avenue and work very hard. Now, what we do is we put male officers in cars to pose as Johns. We put female officers to pose as hookers, and they make cases on their counterparts. Now, we'll do this about 2 or 3 weeks running. We'll expend tens of thousands of dollars. The word gets around, the hookers go to a different section of the city, and the problem merely gets shuffled away. Nothing really is solved. So we chase them all around town. And this is characteristic and historical of the city of Portland, and certainly I think probably Portland is the largest, has the largest amount of this problem in the state of Oregon. What happens as a result of this activity is that neighborhoods literally become degraded. Union Avenue has suffered for literally several generations now. The violence in the neighborhood that comes with this street prostitution is enormous. The citizens try to recapture their streets and their neighborhoods. They get attacked, threatened, intimidated as a result of that behavior. Drugs, in fact, then it brings in a drug, certain street drug activity. It brings in, that kind of behavior which destroys the neighborhood. This is a neighborhood area which essentially has been severely impacted and has essentially been what's called allowed to become a zone where certain behavior is tolerated. It's contained within, and then the rest of the city feels good about it. I don't feel good about it because I live in that neighborhood. And I've owned a house there for many, many, many years. I've raised my family there, and I live there now, and I'm always going to live there. So not only do I have my personal experience as a police officer in enforcing these laws, but I have my experience as a neighborhood resident. And I have the experience of many, many of the people who are constituents who live in that area. I like to talk about traditional confiscation versus the proposed confiscation of vehicles. Traditionally, and as a good representative pointed out, the difference between what's happened in drug trafficking and RICO when we go after their vehicles, we're dealing with people who are involved in an economic crime. They understand that there's a price to pay for their activity. They don't mind losing a Mercedes-Benz now and then. The profits are so enormous, it's just the price you pay for success in narcotics trafficking. In prostitution, you're dealing with a citizen who has on the average is married and has a couple kids. No way in the world is he going to go home and tell mom what happened to that car. He will not risk losing that vehicle. He may very well rent a car. It is possible. But when he does it, he's going to do it on a Visa card. And when the rental company gets the call from the police bureau that car has been seized and is put in a lot somewhere and there are charges against it, they're going to turn around and charge that person those charges. He's going to pay. The rental company is going to get their car back, but the person's going to be held accountable for that. And if the average citizen, next door neighbor, loans somebody a car and they go out and they do that, that's not going to go down very well either. So I think I want to share with you an experience. When I first went public with this issue in the city of Portland several months ago, for 5 days in the Union Avenue area, street prostitution came to a grinding halt. John's disappeared. For some reason, because the press played on it so loud, everybody, those Johns out there, assumed that we had such a law. You know how they sometimes confuse what you read and hear. And they assumed there was such a law, and they didn't go anywhere near the hookers. The hookers started making threatening phone calls to the local newspapers and local people in the area, speaking out against this law that had been passed. Well, no law had been passed. It took them about 5 days, and they figured it out, and they went back to business again. The issue here is I really don't think, all you have to do is confiscate a few of these, and that's going to be the end of that problem. Now, it's a state law that's necessary. We did legal research. If we could have passed a local ordinance to do this, we'd have it in place right now. We'd be enforcing it. But we're prohibited from doing that because it would exceed what the state allows under current legislation. You pass this law, the city of Portland's going to pass a duplicate ordinance, and it's going to go into business. That's really what it comes down to. And we're going to go out there and make those dollars profitable in terms of providing enforcement on an area that is devastating many sections of this community, historically and traditionally. We can begin to make some headway on that. That's what I got to say. I'll answer any questions.
Bob, I had some questions that I put to Representative Minnis, and you were nodding. So I think I know the answer. These are rhetorical to some sense. I was trying to get a feel for some things, and that is the question of the ordinances. Actually, if you have it, one thing would be helpful to this committee. I think you mentioned that the city had looked into the possibility of doing this as a city ordinance.
Yes.
If you have a legal memo from your city attorney,
yes,
that you could provide a copy with us so we'd have that legal background, that'd be helpful.
We're glad to get it to you first thing. Absolutely.
But the question, there's always this term floats around about, gee, if you arrest a seller, you get a seller, you have to arrest a buyer. And I've always understood that was a city ordinance in the city of Portland.
No, what we have is called fair play.